Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
The New Statesman.
Hello, I'm Anoush Shakelian, Britain editor of The New Statesman and host of this podcast. And joining me in the studio, I have our political correspondent, Freddie Haywood, and Rachel Cunliffe, our associate political editor. And this is actually my last week on the podcast for a while because I'm going off on maternity leave. So
yay, congratulations, Anoush.
Thank you. I'll miss being in the studio each week, but, you know, maybe I'll be listening
to
the podcast
in
some horrible, you know, early hours.
Please take a break. Scenario. Don't actually listen to
it. You can introduce the baby to the New Statesman podcast.
Yeah. Forget the
classical
music.
Formative listening experience.
All right. So this is the You Ask Us episode, and we have been looking through our virtual mailbag for your questions. But before that, Rachel and I kind of wanted to hijack the format a bit and ask Freddie some questions. So we ask Freddie, because you were in Brussels this week to report from the NatCon conference, the National Conservative Conference, and it sort of turned into quite a drama, didn't it? So can you just tell us a bit about why you decided to go and then what actually unfolded when you got there?
Yeah, I decided to go just because these National Conservative conferences bring together National Conservatives from around Europe and America, and they're often quite interesting. We saw the one in London last year, which essentially became a Tory knife fight. You had Jacob Rees-Mogg and Suella Braverman and Miriam Cates and Michael Gove all there, essentially pitching themselves for the leadership of the party. Mm. This one was extremely different. This one was much more focused on Europe, the European parliamentary elections in June was they see as a huge opportunity for the nationalist right to take some power and inject some change into Brussels. These only happen every 5 years, so it's a big opportunity for them. So that's why I wanted to go. But it became a much bigger diplomatic international affair, in part because the local mayor in Brussels, he decided to shut down the conference. And he said...
Was there any warning that he was going to do that?
No, so there was some rumours early on in the day on Tuesday, and then we saw his tweet. And this was just the local, it's not the Brussels mayor, it's the local mayor of the area within Brussels. And he just said, the far right is not welcome. I've issued a public order for the police to come down and shut down the event. So these rumours were sort of swirling around, and I don't think people believed them at first. But the organisers already had some issues. This was the third venue that they'd booked because protesters had pressured venue hosts around Brussels to pull their support for them. So this was the third one. We didn't know the night before whether it was still going to go ahead. Anyway, so by mid-morning, Nigel Farage is stomping around on stage regaling tales of all the Brussels cafes and bars that have not welcomed him over the past 20 years when he was an MEP. And three policemen turned up and issued this order to essentially say that you got 50 minutes to leave the premises. I should say, you know, who are at these conferences. So Viktor Orban, the Hungarian Prime Minister, Eric Zemmour, the French presidential candidate. He was this very flamboyant, hard right critic of Islam who is sort of riding a different wave alongside Marine Le Pen. Mm. He's actually got Marion Maréchal, Marine Le Pen's niece in his party, and she'll be standing in the European elections as well. You had Suella Braverman turned up to not much excitement, I must say. Nigel Farage was there. So, and then there was lots of theologians. There was a cardinal for some reason. There was some priests, lots of think tankers. So it was a nationalist rodeo, you could say.
Yeah.
So the police turn up. They essentially say, you have to close it down because we essentially disagree with your views on it because of what the mayor said. Nigel Farage is on stage saying, you know, you'll have to pull me out of here. He was absolutely delighted, gleeful, well-tanned with a jazzy tie on. He came out into the foyer, declared it was Soviet Russia and said he'd never seen such a greater reason for Brexit. They ended up leaving, and then the organisers challenged it in the courts, and there was a compromise essentially with the police lined outside and saying that no one could enter but you could leave. So it was a gradual shutting down of the event as people left.
Right.
So people couldn't get in, and those who were in, if they left, couldn't get back in.
Yeah, quite. So we were sort of stuck there. You had to choose.
So you were sort of held hostage in a way.
Yeah, and then the food couldn't get in for a while, and the drinks couldn't get in. It was
like a sit-in,
like a
basically.
Terrible assignment, I have to say.
But it was quite exciting, really. You know, the police and protesters
no
are right on my street. So yeah, no food. But it continued. That's the key point.
So is that why Suella Braverman was speaking to an empty room, or was she speaking to an empty room because no one wanted to listen to her?
No. Because Nigel Farage went into the foyer and everyone followed him.
So he was stealing her thunder.
Completely. And then Braverman was on stage and I didn't hear what she had to say. And I don't think many people did.
That tells you something, actually, as well about Suella Braverman and the effect and influence she has versus what she thinks she has compared to someone like Nigel Farage. But what was the vibe like after this happened?
People are gleeful. There were the organisers taking photos of one another in front of the police.
Mm.
If anything can prove their point that freedom of speech is under threat at the heart of Europe, it was this. The European Commission's competition authority was 50 metres up the road. The symbolism was undeniable. And I think they felt as if they could go on to declare themselves martyrs and declare that the freedom of speech is under threat, which it clearly was.
What was the rationale for shutting this down?
So that was the tweet from the mayor. He also issued this order, which went through the views of some of the attendees. He said they were homophobic. He also used the words Eurosceptic, as if that was reason to stop people speaking. But the overarching reason was public disorder.
Okay.
So because of their views, he was saying there's a risk that there's going to be a large protest. There was not a large protest. There was a very small protest that came later in the day. I would say it was maybe 100 people, about 30 metres away from the venue. There was no risk of disorder. There was no disorder inside the venue. So I think it was a facade, really. And I think his tweet showed that it was a purely politically motivated. And that's why there was such outrage. The Belgian Prime Minister later that day tweeted that it was against the law. Rishi Sunak ended up condemning the move. And the organisers took it to court and they eventually won. It went to the highest court in Belgium the same day, which I can't really imagine happening here. But
fast-tracked.
So late that night...
At least they're efficient.
Yeah, quite late, late that night they struck down the order and it was able to go on the next day.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're sort of laughing a bit, but it's serious, isn't it? Because one of the main arguments of many of the speakers at these kind of conferences is that, you know, what they want to say is kind of considered beyond the pale by kind of a liberal society or certain institutions that have a lot of influence in people's lives in Europe or in the UK. But there is a sort of truth to it, and and it's not just on the right. So we've got an interesting diary by Yanis Varoufakis, the left-wing economist, the former Greek finance minister, in this week's issue, where he writes actually about quite a similar thing happening. He was at a conference in Germany called a Palestine Congress. He was only speaking over video link. The police invaded the auditorium, grabbed the microphones, tore out the wires of the live streaming equipment. And he said he's been banned not only from going into Germany, but also connecting via video link to events in Germany. And he actually has written defending the National Conservative Conference in Brussels in a piece in Unheard recently, calling this kind of thing a symptom of Europe's slide towards a quagmire of farcical authoritarianism. So it looks like, you know, this kind of new division is not right versus left, but sort of state overreach versus those who want the freedom to say potentially offensive things. And we should say Varoufakis has said controversial things about the Israel-Gaza conflict?
Sure, yeah. I mean, it's the sort of the liberal establishment is going after those both on the hard left, you could say, with Varoufakis, and also the hard right, those at the National Conservative Conference. We've also got it in this country. We've got to remember that the hate speech laws in Scotland have now come into force. They've seen over 7,000 complaints to the police within, you know, the first 2 weeks or so since it's come in. So there's a theme developing, and I think it's been heightened by the conflict in Gaza, in part because so many people are concerned about rising anti-Muslim bigotry and also anti-Semitism, and they're trying to clamp down on that. And in doing so, as we've seen from the Conservative government as well, that they're clamping down on protests and also legitimate political views, however, whatever you think of them.
Yeah, OK. Rachel, we'll go over to your question now. Can you give us a clue on what you've chosen?
Lettuces.
We haven't done lettuce for a while.
We haven't done lettuce for a while.
If you're subscribed to The New Statesman, you can get all our episodes ad-free on the New Statesman app. You can get it on both iOS and Android. Just search for New Statesman on the App Store or Google Play Store. We'll be back after this.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Okay, Rachel, what have you got for us?
Okay, so this question came in 6 days ago before Liz Truss embarked on her press tour of a lifetime. Our listener, Michal, wanted to know, and I expect is even more keen to know now, is Liz Truss even standing at the next general election? Do we know how badly she'd lose if she does? Which is a really interesting question with a lot of assumptions baked into it. Because on current numbers, Liz Truss is actually expected to win her seat.
Yeah, and she is standing.
She is standing, yep. Well, she hasn't said she isn't.
No, she hasn't. Her constituency is southwest Norfolk. And actually, at the risk of, driving attention to potential competition, Will Lloyd, our former colleague, wrote a good piece in the Sunday Times at the weekend about the fight in southwest Norfolk for the seat. But yeah, it's been a Tory seat for 65 years. She's always won with a safe majority since she was first elected in 2010. Her majority now is over 26,000, and like you say, she's expected to hold it. But there is a little bit of turmoil under the surface in this sort of green and pleasant land, because in 2009 there was a local revolt against Truss's candidacy by the Tories there. They were known as the Turnip Taliban, and they were already unhappy with the fact that they felt she'd been parachuted in by sort of David Cameron's central office. But they tried to deselect her after they found out about her affair with a Tory MP, Mark Field. And now one of the Turnip Taliban, James Bagg, is actually standing against her as an independent rather than a conservative. And so there is, you know, it's quite an interesting fight in that seat. I don't know whether it will be enough to oust her. But there is a lot of dissatisfaction, not just in southwest Norfolk, but across the country in Liz Truss. I think there's only sort of 10% who feel positively towards her now in the polling.
I would like to meet some of those 10%.
I know, it's quite high, actually, isn't it?
The seat is interesting in the same way that Mid-Bedfordshire was interesting, Nadine Dorries' seat, and it's a really, really safe Tory area. But there is local frustration with having a non-local MP parachuted in. As you say, she's not well liked in the constituency. She didn't send her kids to school in the constituency. She's not from that area. And the guy who's standing against her, who I'm actually going to meet in Norfolk next week, is a lifelong conservative who doesn't feel that Liz Truss is a conservative. So it's a very there's big farming communities, sort of rural constituency. So I think there is a conservative movement against her who feel that she is not sort of fully conservative, which could be quite interesting. That said, it's an absolutely seismic majority. It's bigger than any of the majorities that the Conservatives have lost, even in the recent by-election defeats. So it's going to be a tough one for anyone running against her. She's not necessarily doing herself favours as a local constituency MP with her book tour, although as both Freddie and I have written this week, it's likely that she has another motivation when it comes to her book and some of the things that she's been saying.
Yeah, well, tell us about this book tour. She's been everywhere this week. The book is 10 Years to Save the West. What's the main message coming out of the interviews that she's doing and the reviews that are coming out of the book so far?
Well, she's blaming everybody but herself for what happened in the mini budget. She's come out against the deep state. She's come out against the Bank of England. She's called for Andrew Bailey, the governor of the Bank of England, to go. She's also criticised the OBR, the Conservative Party. What else have I missed, Rachel?
Abolish the UN.
She wants to abolish the UN. She's. I think what she's essentially doing is she's leaning into this general scepticism towards what would be called globalism. Essentially, it's a scepticism of institutions such as the World Health Organization, the UN, but also sort of extra political domestic institutions like the Supreme Court, which was only set up in 2007 by Tony Blair, like the OBR, which was only set up in 2010. I don't think that is a particularly radical, outrageous point of view to hold. What is slightly strange is that she uses it as the explanation, the key to why she failed. It was nothing to do with her lack of, as she terms it, her lack of people management skills. It was nothing to do with short-sightedness or a failure to communicate or her complete and utter derogation of the party or the fact that she didn't appoint any of Rishi Sunak's allies into her cabinet or the fact that she didn't think about the markets or look into the LDI pension problem or that why she didn't communicate with Kwasi Kwarteng before party conference. So she doesn't look at anything that she did. So you've got this slightly strange situation where she's trotting round TV studios in London with this glazed-eyed, crazed obsession with the Supreme Court. And I think that's a completely valid point of view. It's not as, the Supreme Court and the OBR are not institutions of the Glorious Revolution. Criticise them all you want. But there's a misdiagnosis of what happened.
Yeah, and there's also a bit of it's a strange contradiction, isn't it, this rejection of, like you say, this globalist order, when she's one of the authors of Britannia Unchained. She was one of the wannabe architects of a global Britain. The reason her and Suella Braverman originally had that falling out and Braverman was ousted from her cabinet was because of an argument about immigration.
Yeah, about visas, about skilled visas. So not illegal immigration, about skilled visas and student visas. So there's always been this contradiction with what Liz Truss has tried to do since leaving office, in that the sort of hardcore free market, break down barriers, no tariffs, everyone should be able to trade globally, trade goods, people should be able to move, low taxes, low regulation. That model is fundamentally at odds with the more populist, we need to protect the nation state, which is sort of similar to what the National Conservatives were talking about or trying to talk about in Brussels, low immigration. And Liz Truss has sort of tried to blend the two together with this idea that the woke blob, the establishment, the deep state, she's used the term the deep state, were against her from the start, and to try and iron out those contradictions. And she tried that at the Popular Conservatism launch in February, and then a week later she spoke at CPAC, which is this conference of Republicans and Conservatives in the US, and she tried it again in her book. So it is deeply contradictory, but what she is trying to speak to is, as Freddie said, suspicion with institutions and this idea that democratically elected governments don't have the power that they used to have or that they should have, because that power is in the courts or the institutions or the markets. And it is not a particularly coherent worldview, but there is genuine suspicion, fear, anger, and I think it's trying to answer a question that the Conservative Party is really struggling with, which is, we've been in power for 14 years, we have very little to show for it, taxes are really high, why haven't we been able to achieve the things that we wanted to do? Immigration's high, even though we keep saying, the Conservatives keep saying we want to bring it down, and their answer, Liz Truss's answer, is we couldn't be conservative because the institutions were all stacked against us. I think it's very telling that the tagline of her book, 10 Years to Save the West, the tagline is "The lessons from the only conservative in the room," which I think says it all.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, you've reported sort of very closely on Truss's sort of life after being prime minister. How much does she believe the stuff that she's saying now? How much of it is just to sort of appeal to this American audience that's more of the national conservative bent than the free marketeer bent? Or has being prime minister actually changed her mind about some of the things that get in the way of governing?
It's a really interesting question. Some people say it's just about the money, because obviously the right-wing speaking circuit in the US is very lucrative. I've spoken to people who've worked very closely with her, and I think she does genuinely believe this. And mm-hmm. one thing that is often said about Liz Truss is that she completely lacks self-awareness, and that she sort of has no idea how she comes across. And actually, I think she knows exactly how she comes across. And I think she knows she's, in her own words, according to a book written about her, a bit weird. She knows that she doesn't connect with people the way that other politicians do. And I think she is leaning into that, and she is using that to try and get attention for her message that she genuinely believes. Now, whether she was always like that, or whether 7 weeks in office where it all fell apart has changed her worldview, I'm not sure. But I do think it's genuine. I don't think it's an act.
Okay. And what are the political implications of having Truss everywhere? I mean, I feel like within the Labour Party, this is what they always want. They want Truss to be sort of front and centre.
She's an amazing campaigner for the Labour Party. She shows that every single day. I think they're absolutely delighted with the past week. They don't have to talk about Angela Rayner, for instance. I mean, Angela Rayner's minor tax problems, even though there are questions about her honesty wrapped up in that, pale in significance in the news round or the headlines. Mm-hmm. Once you put Liz Truss's bombastic interviews day after day in. So I think they're very happy. It's very bad for Rishi Sunak, and this has been the tale of his premiership so far. He should have, as we've said before, and we've argued many times, he should have come out immediately and say, "I disagree with Liz Truss. She was wrong with the economy. She was wrong in the way that she viewed the party." And I said this during the leadership election. If he had done so, he might have had a chance to unclasp this baggage of Liz Truss and Boris Johnson. Instead, he tried to go for party unity, which obviously lasted a couple of weeks, if that. And he's not been able to recover.
And he tried it in PMQs this week. He was asked about Liz Truss, but he said, you know, everyone remembers, or everyone knows, that I spoke out very much against this 2 years ago. And what's interesting is that I'm not sure everyone does know that, because yes, he did speak out against it, but then he went very quiet about it for the next 18 months. So I think it's interesting that he's trying to draw that line now, although, as Freddie says, it is too late. And I saw a really interesting Labour campaign ad this week, which was Liz Truss on the broadcast round saying that she feels she has unfinished business, and then morphing to footage of Rishi Sunak and pointing out that Liz Truss quote-unquote crashed the economy, as Labour are saying, with £45 billion of unfunded tax cuts, and then drawing a line between that and Rishi Sunak suggesting that at some point his ambition might be to abolish national insurance, which would cost £46 billion, which Labour are spinning as another £46 billion of unfunded tax cuts. And it sort of cuts to her going unfinished business. And you can see, I mean, the Conservatives would probably say this is very crude and very unfair, but you can see what Labour's doing here, making a very clear link between the two of them, and a link between Rishi Sunak's possible fiscal plans and what everyone remembers from autumn 2022. And I think it'll be quite effective.
Interesting. All right. Well, thanks so much, both of you. I'm really going to miss being
in
the studio
with
you
both.
Yeah. And I know you will take very good care of the podcast while I'm away. So looking forward to listening what you do with it. Thanks so much to everyone who has submitted questions. We read them all, so you can keep them coming in. If you'd like to send one, you can go to newstatesman.com/youaskus. And if you're listening on Spotify, you can just scroll down on the episode page and leave a reply there. And YouTube viewers can drop a question in the comments. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Anoush Shakelian, and my colleagues Freddie Hayward and Rachel Cunliffe. We'll be back tomorrow to discuss the UK's divided response to the Iran and Israel conflict. This episode was produced by Catherine Hughes.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.
Trust in politics is broken. So can we get UK politics working again?
That was the last time we were happy. 2012.
I'm Beth Rigby, Sky's political editor. Join me every week with Labour's Jess Phillips and Conservative peer Ruth Davidson for some electoral dysfunction.
This idea of nuance has completely left politics. Yeah.
Together we'll focus on the policies that could deliver political satisfaction. Follow Electoral Dysfunction wherever you get your podcasts.